I'm Tracy Sable tonight on EWTN News Nightly, strained relations. The Prime Minister of Ireland visits the White House amid tension over the handling of the Israel-Hamas war. Pro-life pushback. Lawmakers respond to President Biden's budget, which they say highlights an abortion agenda. The church will remain. A priest in Cuba weighs in on the battle between Catholicism and communism. And a lot to learn. Bishop Robert Barron announces a new initiative aimed at evangelization amid the current culture. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. Our top story tonight, President Joe Biden welcomes Ireland's Prime Minister to the White House for a bilateral meeting, but it is not the normal, smiling, celebratory St. Patrick's Day visit this year. Not with horrific wars across the globe, leaving thousands dead or wounded, while peace remains elusive. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Tracy, with the war in the Middle East raging, Prime Minister Leo Varadkar came here to Washington with a strong message for President Biden concerning the ongoing suffering in Gaza. The Prime Minister earlier warned, quote, "The cries of the innocent will haunt us forever if we stay silent," end quote. Today, the two met in the Oval Office, and some wanted the Prime Minister to boycott the U.S. trip.
May the hinge of our friendship never go rusty.
With those warm words, President Joe Biden says hello to and sits down with Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar, but the conversation soon turning to war.
I'm urging them to, the Congress to pass the bipartisan legislation now. It includes a significant amount of humanitarian aid, including to Ukraine and Gaza.
And Gaza very much on the mind of the Prime Minister, who is facing pressure back home to skip the Oval Office meeting with President Biden because of the war in Gaza, to show disapproval towards the U.S. actions there. And word today that Israel has just now approved military plans to attack Rafah, the southernmost town in Gaza, where the majority of the embattled strip's population is sheltering. After the meeting, the Irish Prime Minister addressed reporters.
And then, of course, talked about the situation in the Middle East, in Israel and Palestine, restated Ireland's call for an immediate ceasefire to allow food and medicine and aid to get into Gaza, the killing to stop, the hostages to get out.
Also in the Oval Office, President Biden expressing support for Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer after the senator called for new elections in Israel, believing that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has lost his way and is an obstacle to peace in the region.
Senator Schumer contacted my staff, my senior staff. He's going to make that speech, and I'm not going to elaborate on the speech. He made a good speech, and I think he expressed a serious concern shared not only by him but by many Americans.
Now, President Biden today also told Ireland's Prime Minister that a whole lot more needs to be done in Gaza. In addition, Leo Varadkar and President Biden both support a two-state solution. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Coming up later in the newscast, analysis of Senator Schumer's remarks and some of the pushback that he received. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has convened the war cabinet in Tel Aviv. This following the news that, according to Hamas, it has put forward a new proposal for a ceasefire. The new measure is said to be similar to the previous proposed plan that was aiming to be finished before the start of the holy month of Ramadan. No official details of that plan have been released. A ship carrying 200 tons of aid has arrived in Gaza after making the journey from Cyprus. The mission was meant to test a sea route in an effort to funnel more aid to the war-torn region. The ship is operated by the Spanish aid group Open Arms. This comes as the United States and several other countries keep up airdrops of aid into the region. The U.S. has announced separate plans to construct a bridge to deliver aid. A federal judge has rejected one bid by former President Donald Trump to throw out his classified documents criminal case. U.S. District Judge Aileen Cannon, in her ruling, said that even though Trump's team raised various arguments warranting serious consideration, a dismissal of charges was not merited. The ruling did not address another motion the Trump team had used to try and get the charges dismissed. It also did not offer any clarity as to when the case might move to trial. Now to the election subversion case against Donald Trump and a late-breaking development. Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade, who was leading the case against Trump, has resigned. Earlier, a judge ruled that District Attorney Fannie Willis could prosecute the case if Wade was removed. The judge found the appearance of impropriety brought about by the previously undisclosed romantic relationship between the two should result in one of them leaving the case. The judge admonished Willis for dating Wade, whom she had hired as a special prosecutor on the case, calling it a tremendous lapse of judgment. And here to talk to us more about the case is Anthony Michael Kress, assistant professor of law at Georgia State University. Sir, good to be with you today. So help us break this down. What does this really mean, and is it really a win for Willis?
Yeah, I think at the bottom of this, it's a huge win for Fannie Willis because it keeps the case completely within her control and within the purview of her office. And she really doesn't have to give up much because I don't think most people who've observed this case think that Nathan Wade was really creating the legal theory and the strategy behind her prosecution here, but rather he was more of a team manager and behind the scenes guy. So it's probably not a huge loss for her in that sense. And whatever, you know, drubbing she took today as a political matter, because Judge McAfee did certainly note that her ethics were lacking here. I think that will probably pass with time. And again, ultimately for her, she just wanted to keep control of this case.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, he did use this phrase, a tremendous lapse of judgment and appearance of impropriety, that is. What do you make of that?
Well, I think anybody who's been watching this unfold acknowledges that the relationship in the first instance was incredibly unwise. It would have been unwise in any situation, but especially in a case that is so important, so salient, and so controversial like this one, you would want to make sure as the head of the district attorney's office that you do everything by the book and that you are beyond reproach, even if you're not doing something that actually prejudices defendants in any way. And so I think that was one thing that Judge McAfee pointed out. But the other thing that he pointed out was that the DA's response to this in many respects was not wise either. She gave a speech in a church here in Atlanta that Judge McAfee thought crossed the line. And she also was pretty hostile as a witness on the witness stand during the evidentiary hearing that Judge McAfee held a few weeks ago. And so I think between all of that, this could have been responded to and addressed in a much more responsible, professional way. And that's what he criticized her for today.
Yeah, and do you think the publicity surrounding this case, you know, the relationship, all of that, do you think that will have an actual impact on the actual case here?
I think it's very unlikely that that will happen, in large part because we are probably many, many months away from a trial beginning here in Fulton County, especially because there are other trials, right, that Donald Trump has to be present for, and that will affect the timeline here in addition to whatever appeals and other motions have to be dispensed with over the coming weeks and months. So we're looking at a very long-term time frame here before a trial starts. People generally have very short memories, and so I don't think that most folks will be talking about this 8 or 10 months from now. And certainly the voir dire process, right, the process in which we ensure that jurors are impartial and able to render a decision based on the evidence and evidence alone, that'll take care of anybody who has some lingering doubts as a result of this, I suspect.
Yeah, any final thoughts on this before we let you go?
I just think that we're in a very long haul here in Fulton County, and so anybody who thinks we're going to go to trial, you know, should kind of hold on and wait and see what happens. It'll be a much longer road than not here.
Well, Anthony Michael Kress, sir, thank you so much for weighing in. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
President Biden sent his budget to Congress this week. It takes aim at longtime pro-life policies that have been part of the federal landscape for almost 40 years, pro-life lawmakers accuse the administration of trying to impose an abortion on demand agenda.
One rider after another, every one of them would be destroyed by this budget if he were to have his way. So it is the harbinger of what he wants in a second term. He's not going to get it this term. But if he gets a second term, he will be the abortion president on steroids.
The budget drops the Hyde Amendment, which bans the use of taxpayer dollars for abortions. It calls for more funding for contraceptives, family planning, and teen pregnancy programs. Susan B. Anthony, Pro-Life America, wrote, "Joe Biden is fond of saying, 'Show me your budget, and I'll tell you what you value.' The Biden-Harris administration's clear priority is pushing all trimester abortions with no limits, even when babies in the womb can feel pain, paid for with taxpayer dollars." President Biden also called for Congress to pass the Women's Health Protection Act, authored by Congresswoman Judy Chu, that Democrats promised to reintroduce.
This legislation would provide Americans a right to receive and doctors a right to provide abortion care free from state bans and restrictions that impede.
The budget release comes just before the next round of six government funding bills that must be passed by March 22nd.
We will not accept any, not one, not tiny, not little, not big abortion rider on these bills, and have made that very clear. It's why we have six bills today without any on it, and we will have six more without any on it.
And there's more. Pro-life Senator Roger Marshall, a doctor, put forward a bill this week to stop the Biden administration from forcing transgender ideology in foster care.
Joe Biden is attacking our religious freedoms. His latest step is to try to force Christian organizations out of the foster children organizations, that they no longer want Christians, Jewish folks that would be able to participate in foster children programs.
With a November election approaching, the National Republican Congressional Committee has issued new guidelines to help House GOP candidates help define their own pro-life positions and defend against attacks by Democrats. The Supreme Court of Wisconsin says that a major Catholic charity group cannot claim a religious tax exemption. Catholic Charities Bureau has filed a lawsuit claiming the state had improperly removed its designation as a religious organization. The court says a religious motivation on its own is not enough to receive the tax exemption. The group has now lost a key tax break and also must pay into the state unemployment system. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including elections in Russia. Voters head to the polls this weekend with Vladimir Putin as an overwhelming favorite. Continues to pour in after Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's comments yesterday calling for new elections in Israel and sharply criticizing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's handling of the war with Hamas. Netanyahu's Likud party responded, saying the New York Democrat, quote, is expected to respect Israel's elected government and not to undermine it. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson says Schumer's remarks were, quote, highly inappropriate, adding it's just plain wrong for an American leader to play such a divisive role in Israeli politics, especially during a time of war. And here to analyze Senator Schumer's comments is Harley Lippman, foreign policy expert and executive committee member on the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Harley, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. First, I want to get your thoughts on Senator Schumer's comments calling for new elections in Israel.
Well, what's interesting about this is that it really fits incredibly well within Biden and Bibi Netanyahu's political strategy. Why? Because for Biden, Schumer's speech was welcomed because he's trying to shore up support among the liberal progressives, and he's worried about Arab Americans who are less likely to vote for the Democrats. So this ought to help him with that group. And then for Bibi Netanyahu, if there's one issue that that Israelis are united on, it's not to have a Palestinian state right now. So this helps Bibi internally. So ironically, we should just be aware of the real reasons and the real impact of that debate and Schumer's speech as to how it impacts Bibi at home and Biden in the United States.
Yeah, and as you know, though, those comments by Senator Schumer, I mean, it really did set off a firestorm of reaction, both here in the U.S. and also internationally. Talk to us more about that. What do you make of that, and are you surprised?
Well, Schumer is saying what a lot of people feel. A lot of people are unhappy with Bibi Netanyahu. But at the same time, he's become a scapegoat for everybody's frustration or their anger with Israel or their anti-Semitism or their worry about this getting into a global war. You know, on the right, Bibi is criticized for not protecting Israel from the attack of Hamas on October 7th. From the left, as Schumer pointed out, people think he has a right-wing coalition because he wants to stay in power and he wants to make sure he doesn't go to jail. So that's the backdrop of all this. But yes, you know, I like to say there are many truths. Yes, it is unprecedented to interfere in another democracy. You could reverse it and say, how would we feel if foreign leaders said that you should vote for Biden or you should vote for Trump? You could imagine a reaction here. So that is unsettling to Israelis. But if you're left of center, you would tend to welcome Schumer's speech because, again, a lot of people are focusing on Bibi Netanyahu and his right-wing government. But at the end of the day, the reality is that Israel was attacked. They have a right to defend themselves, and they should be allowed to win. If they're not, Hamas has already stated many times that they will do this 2, 3, 4 times more. And if Israel does not go into Rafah, where Hamas has 4 battalions and where the remaining hostages are, as I said, they'll emerge from the rubble, whether it's a temporary ceasefire or a permanent ceasefire, and they'll say, look, we withstood the military onslaught of one of the most powerful militaries in the world, and we're still here. They'll have a victory. It'll galvanize Hamas. It'll galvanize radical Islam. It will galvanize Iran. And the situation in the Middle East, I suspect, will get much worse. There'll be more war and more violence. So ironically, while people think Israel shouldn't go into Rafah, and that would be a good thing, it's the opposite. What will bring peace will be strength. Israel, somebody has to win this war. It'll go on forever. So it's important, I think, to let Israel win. Yes.
Yeah, Harley, continue. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's important for Israel to be able to win this war because it's a war against a very dark, terrible driving force, and it has nothing to do with the Palestinian nation. Hamas did not attack Israel on October 7th because they want a Palestinian nation. They do not want a Palestinian nation. They want a caliphate. So this has nothing to do with the Palestine. And Israel's not against the Palestinian nation. Even Bibi Netanyahu said he accepts a Palestinian nation. He can't walk that back. So I think there's a little bit of jousting between Netanyahu and Biden. It's negotiations also. I think everybody agrees that in the long term, probably a Palestinian nation is inevitable. But the key question is, what will it look like? If there's not good governance with independent democratic institutions, a free press, an independent judiciary, it will be like Hamas and worse. So it's not about having a Palestinian nation, because there was a Palestine, Gaza. Israel left in 2006. Gaza, the people in Gaza elected Hamas. They've been in power for 19 years, and what have they done? They don't care about their people. They exploit their people. They don't hide their people in the tunnels. They don't have air raid shelters. They just want to defeat Israel in the public relations war by making sure they'd rather have a dead Palestinian baby than do something constructive for the Palestinian people.
Oh, Harley, so much more we can talk about. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so much for weighing in, for your time. We do appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Our Russians are headed to the polls today to cast their vote in the 3-day election for president. There are 4 candidates running for president, but the overwhelming favorite is the current president, Vladimir Putin. Putin has held the position since 2000 and changed the constitution to permit himself another term in office. International observers have expressed concern over the fairness of the election. The results are expected Sunday night. When Ukrainian first responders arrived to help following a Russian missile strike in Odessa, they were met with yet another missile. At least 16 people were killed, with another 53 wounded. This comes as Russia has intensified its attacks in the area. The regional governor says a day of mourning will be held in Odessa on Saturday, the second in less than 2 weeks. And there is an effort to shore up Ukraine's military resources. Today, the leaders of Germany, Poland, and France met in Berlin. In a sign of unity, they vowed to get more weapons to Kyiv in their fight against the Russians. In the past, French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz have expressed differences over the strategies regarding Ukraine. Up next on EWTN News Nightly, Communism and the Catholic Church. An update on the faithful in Cuba from a Catholic priest critical of the government. Plus, a new initiative from Bishop Robert Barron and the new evangelization. In Cuba has renewed his criticism of the country's communist government. In an interview with EWTN Noticias, Father Alberto Reyes said in part, quote, communism won't survive, but the church will remain. Father Alberto also says that his small town was once flourishing and is now full of, quote, sadness, migration, and deprivation. He also says that he has learned not to be taken captive by fear. A Catholic NFL football star is speaking out. Harrison Butker is the kicker for the Kansas City Chiefs. In an exclusive interview with EWTN, he expresses sorrow after a Catholic fan was killed at the Chiefs' Super Bowl victory parade.
Lisa Lopez Galvin shot and killed. She was wearing your jersey, also a fellow Catholic.
She appreciated the fact that I was a Catholic, that I was outspoken for my faith, and that is just encouragement. For me to never waver in my beliefs, to be unapologetically Catholic. And it's so sad to think about the way that she, you know, had to leave us.
And to see more of Mark Iron's interview, tune in to EWTN News In Depth tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern. That interview will also be posted in its entirety online. So check that out. The Pontifical Gregorian University hosted a debate earlier this week focused on woke culture. The Acton Institute, together with the university, sponsored the event. It featured more than 300 leaders in church social thought. EWTN Vatican Bureau Chief Andreas Tannhauser had the opportunity to interview one of the participants, Dr. Michael Miller.
Michael, could you tell us a little bit more, why do you organize a conference on truth, justice, and liberty?
I think the big questions today are, like, what does it mean to be a human person? And there's a lot of confusion about actually what it means to be an embodied, embedded person. And there's a lot of different visions about the human person that are out, whether it's materialism, the person as a scourge for the environment, or transhumanism, or even this idea of plastic anthropology, that the person has no nature or no essence. And also this idea of the person as a commodity that just can be traded. And I think when we think about truth and justice and liberty, if we're going to think about it clearly, we first have to think about what does it mean to be a human person. And as John Paul II always explained and taught, the human being is not an object, but a subject to be respected and not socially engineered or not manipulated, but always should be the protagonist of their own story of development.
You chose to place this conference here in Rome. You organized it here in Rome. Do you find on the notions of wokeism, extreme relativism, is that the same in the U.S. as here in Europe?
Well, I think it's a pretty broad European and American problem. But not only that, I mean, as Pope Francis says, you know, there's a problem of ideological colonization. And so you see these ideas of really plastic anthropology or certain kind of progressive understandings of the family and et cetera, not just in the United States, not just in Europe, but being spread through, say, for example, foreign policy or foreign aid or various other things. So I think it's a problem that we all have to contend with. And as you know, one of the themes is that we're in an anthropological struggle. Like, what does it mean to be a human being? And the Christian understanding, the Catholic understanding of the human person is really, John Paul says, like, it transformed the world in ancient times. And it can do that same thing today. And so I think this is why there's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of despair. People are nervous. People are not sure who they are. And I think a lot of it comes from this, in fact, fundamental question of what does it mean to be a person?
What's your response, or how do you see the church responding to these developments in society?
Well, I think the church has key things to do, and as it always has to done. You know, I mean, I think it's St. Augustine said something like, don't wish to live in the future, or don't live in the past. You know, be content with where God puts you. And the church has the message, I would say, you know, the good news, the gospel. Part of the gospel is the good news, the gospel about the human person, what it means to be a human person. So I think the church has to teach anthropology. I think continue to teach and revive, maybe even, the theology of the body that John Paul so developed so well. The church has to be, as Pope Benedict said, the defender of reason. You know, Pope Francis, again, talks about ideological colonization. So we're in the debate over what does it mean to be a person. So the church has this. And I think also the church is teaching, promoting the gospel and the liturgy, which is a non-linguistic way of catechesis. That is, it teaches the beauty and the dignity of the person created in the image of God, not necessarily through words, right, but through the beauties of liturgy and art. So the Catholic Church has always had the message of Christ to the world, and that's the good news that transformed so many lives. I know it transformed mine, probably transformed yours. And so the Catholic Church always has something to say and is always relevant.
And we thank Andreas Tannhauser for bringing us that report. Well, finally, tonight, a new master's program seeks to provide the church with the best-formed evangelists that it can provide. The Word on Fire Institute, together with the University of St. Thomas, Houston, announced that they are launching a master's program in evangelization and culture this summer. It will provide students a chance to be formed in the Word on Fire nature in an accredited way. Word on Fire founder Bishop Robert Barron is closely involved in the program and may also teach. It is set to begin in June. And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night and God bless.